Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. My name is Lauren Litton, and I am the host of Spotlight on Youth, a radio show dedicated to social and legal trends impacting the rights and well-being of children across the country. I just want to say first that my thoughts go out to everyone who has been or may be affected by the earthquake and tsunami. As a reminder to our listeners, the show is being streamed live over the Internet and will be available on demand after its conclusion. We encourage you to participate by asking our guests questions live on air by dialing 347-994-1149. That is 347-994-1149, and then you're going to press the number 1 on your telephone keypad to indicate you have a question, and you will be placed in the queue. Also, feel free to log into the chat room and pose a question there. We had a show in December on the Juvenile Detention Alternatives Initiative, or JDAI, and it had approximately 1,700 downloads. Due to the great interest, we wanted to have a follow-up episode dedicated to JDAI's implementation. We have three people joining us today from New Jersey, which is a model state JDAI program. Our guests have graciously agreed to discuss their experiences and offer recommendations to listeners seeking alternatives to detention for youth in their own jurisdictions or states. Our guests are the Honorable Charles Rand, who is the presiding judge of the family part in Camden County. Originally sworn in as Superior Court Judge in 1992, he has also been acting assignment judge since 2007. Judge Rand was appointed chair of the FDFM subcommittee of the Conference of Presiding Judges. Previously, he served as a municipal court judge in several Camden County municipalities, and when practicing law, did so in both private practice and with a law firm. He is a former president of the Camden County Conference of Municipal Court Judges and has served as the chair of the Camden-Gloucester County Fee Arbitration Panel. Judge Rand has held every office, including president of the Camden County Bar Association, and is a frequent lecturer for many organizations, including the Association for Trial Lawyers of America and New Jersey's Institute for Continuing Legal Education. Judge Rand received his bachelor's from Rutgers University and his law degree from Rutgers School of Law, Camden. David Sharp is originally from Jamaica and immigrated to the United States in 1979. In college, he interned in the Witness Aid Services Unit of the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, and that experience began his interest in law. After graduating law school, David went to work as an assistant prosecutor at the Hudson County Prosecutor's Office, where he has thus far dedicated his career. He has been involved in all types and levels of prosecution. 10 years ago, after being assigned a gang-related homicide and realizing its effect on kids, he returned to the juvenile unit and for the past 5 years has volunteered to supervise a unit in an effort to effect meaningful change in children's lives. He represents the office on the Statewide Council for Juvenile Justice Systems Improvement, is a member of both the Waiver and Detention Utilization Subcommittees, and serves as the chair of the Local Detention Alternative Case Processing Joint Subcommittees. He received his bachelor's from SUNY Oneonta, and his Juris Doctorate from Benjamin N. Cordoza School of Law. Lisa, and I hope I get your last name right now. Is it Macaluso?
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Is the president of Macaluso and Associates, a consulting company specializing in juvenile justice system reform, justice issues, and organizational development. She is also currently the director of the Future Project, a National Juvenile Justice Fellowship Program at the Center for Children's Law and Policy in Washington, D.C., and serves as a team leader for the Annie E. Casey Foundation's national JDAI work. Previously, Lisa has served as a deputy director of crime prevention for the New Jersey Attorney General's Office, the director of the Office of Local Programs and Services for the New Jersey Juvenile Justice Commission, and New Jersey's JDAI state coordinator. Currently, Lisa is a co-team leader for New Jersey's JDAI through the Annie E. Casey Foundation, as well as a graduate of the Casey Foundation's JDAI Applied Leadership Network. Welcome all to all three of you to spotlight on youth.
Good afternoon.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
This is the first time we've had three guests, so it should be a very dynamic conversation. Lisa, maybe you can help start us off. I mentioned we had a previous episode on JDAI, but for those who did not listen to that show or who are getting old like me and can't even remember what they had for breakfast, could you provide a quick overview of JDAI, including its 8 core strategies?
Sure, I'd be happy to, Lauren. So JDAI was designed to support the Casey Foundation's vision that all youth involved in the juvenile justice system have opportunities to develop into healthy, productive adults. JDAI focuses on the juvenile detention component of the juvenile justice system because we know that youth are often unnecessarily or inappropriately detained at great expense with long-lasting negative consequences for both public safety and for youth development. And since its inception in 1992, JDAI has repeatedly demonstrated that jurisdictions can safely reduce reliance on secure detention. And there are now approximately 100 JDAI sites in 24 states and the District of Columbia. The way JDAI does this is it provides a framework for reducing the over-reliance on unnecessary and inappropriate uses of secure detention. And so the framework includes these 8 core strategies that you speak of. They are collaboration and leadership, basically meaning that jurisdictions doing this work will develop a collaborative body that's charged with implementing JDAI. They're charged with doing a critical self-analysis of their justice system policy and practice. They're charged with identifying places of improvement or in need of improvement. And then they work to develop strategies to improve those places and track the outcomes to make sure that we're getting the results we were hoping for. Leaders of these groups must create a safe place for these conversations because the whole sort of goal is to identify places for improvement. So we want to make sure that there's a reasonable place to do that in the collaborative. The collaborative also uses data in order to diagnose their system, make informed changes, and track the outcomes. What we know about using data is it helps people see the system all from the same set of facts instead of from their different places in their work. And so reliance on data helps jurisdictions to make small changes over time that lead to significant reductions in the number of youth detained while maintaining public safety and ensuring court appearance. We also ask in the core strategies that folks look at controlling admissions to detention. And what that essentially means is that we want to ensure that detention is being used according to its statutory purpose, following the principle of using the least restrictive alternative necessary to make sure youth appear in court and remain arrest-free while their case is pending. In general, most times folks will implement a risk screening tool in order to guide these decisions. And the screening tools, or sometimes known as risk assessment instruments, are comprised of measures related to the statutory purpose of detention, meaning factors that reflect either both offense seriousness and flight risk. And hand-in-hand with controlling admissions to detention, jurisdictions look at developing and implementing effective detention alternative programs. Detention alternative programs serve youth who would otherwise be placed in secure detention, providing a level of supervision sufficient to safely maintain these youth in the community rather than in the detention center. Common types of detention alternative programs include day or evening reporting centers, in-home detention, electronic monitoring, and shelter care. And generally speaking, we see this continuum of detention alternative programs plus the detention center itself as a detention process. So this continuum provides decision makers with a range of options in terms of levels of security for supervising youth while keeping the community safe and while moving the case to disposition. We also ask folks to look at reducing length of stay, and from this perspective, we know that detention populations are made up of admissions and length of stay. So length of stay basically means looking at case processing or how long the time is from adjudication to disposition. And this core strategy is really not about treading on the rights of children in terms of making things go so fast that we trample on kids' rights. But what it is about is looking for and eliminating wasted time in case processing. So, for example, looking at the number of continuances that a jurisdiction might have that are caused by not having the dispositional placement ready right away, trying to improve on that, or looking at and ensuring the timely assignment of attorneys to cases. Those are the kinds of things that we look at for reducing case processing. And handling special cases, meaning primarily probation violations, technical probation violations and warrants. These are cases where decision makers often rely on secure detention as a consequence for a violation. So this core strategy asks jurisdictions to figure out why detention is relied upon in these cases and whether there's any portion of these populations that might be handled differently. Eliminating racial, ethnic, and gender disparities is essentially about ensuring that similarly situated youth receive similar outcomes. And in too many jurisdictions around the country, minority youth and young ladies are often overrepresented in the secure detention center. So we strongly encourage jurisdictions to view all the core strategies through the racial and gender lens, which means we're asking that they disaggregate all information by race and gender and examine all their reform efforts in terms of the potential impact on different racial, ethnic, and gender groups. This is a really important core strategy. It goes through everything else that we do, and it leads, when done well, to equity and fairness for all youth in the juvenile justice system. And finally, we know that even with all of these efforts, there will always be youth that need to be confined in the detention center itself. And so the final core strategy is about holding ourselves accountable for ensuring our detention facilities present conditions of confinement that meet basic constitutional, statutory, and professional standards, and then pushing further that we strive to meet best practice standards for youth who are in detention and also for the staff that work there every single day.
Great. Thanks for the overview.
Sure.
Now, I kind of want to turn to what's happening in the state, and then we'll filter down into the local counties. In 2004, I believe, New Jersey was named a replication site. For those of us who are not in the JDAI world, what does that mean?
So when JDAI began, its implementation was primarily county-based. And as the initiative started to grow all over the country and counties became interested in doing this work, it became pretty apparent to the foundation that the foundation couldn't go to all 3,141 counties in the country and implement this work. And so in 2002, the foundation put out an RFP for what they called state-scale implementation of JDAI. And though the term state-scale can mean different things, in New Jersey's case, the state agencies responsible for youth in court committed themselves to lead the initiative, the implementation of the initiative, and to bring the initiative to all 21 counties in New Jersey. But replication in and of itself means taking the eight core strategies and applying it to your jurisdiction or various jurisdictions if you're a state site.
And so how is the JDAI effort in New Jersey organized?
New Jersey's Juvenile Justice Commission is the lead agency for JDAI under the current leadership of Executive Director Valeria Lawson and Deputy Executive Director of Programs, Dr. Gloria Hancock. And that agency partners with the New Jersey Administrative Office of the Courts under the leadership of Chief Justice Stuart Rabner and Acting Administrative Director of the Courts, the Honorable Gwen Grant. New Jersey's collaboratives are called Councils on Juvenile Justice System Improvement. We want the name to reflect what the folks are doing around that table. And those collaboratives at the state level, the collaborative is made up of judges, trial court administrators, probation representatives, prosecutors, police, public defenders, child welfare folks, education, county administrators, detention administrators, and child advocates. Anyone that you would think needs to be at that table is there. And then there are county-based collaboratives or councils on juvenile justice system improvement. And those county-based collaboratives have similar representation at their table at the local level. The local folks are charged with implementing JDAI at the county level. And the state collaborative that has representation from each of the local sites plus a whole bunch of state people is responsible for looking at cross-cutting issues around the state and trying to work on sort of the bigger picture of juvenile justice across the counties. So the Juvenile Justice Commission runs the day-to-day operations of the initiative under the leadership of Pat Walker, Director of Local Programs and Services, and Dr. Jennifer LeBaron, the state JDAI coordinator. A critical component of the model, though, is the detention specialists that work with the JJC to implement JDAI at the state level and at the county level. The detention specialists are responsible for collecting and analyzing data. They're responsible for ensuring fidelity to the JDAI model. They help sites find solutions to issues that come up and problems that they identify through this critical self-analysis. And really, in general, they're the glue that keeps the sites moving forward in their work.
How many jurisdictions are we talking about in New Jersey? Because you're talking about the local, county, and state levels are involved in implementing JDAI.
Yes. So when we started, we were looking. There's 21 counties in New Jersey. When we started and we talked about state scale, we had 17 counties with juvenile detention centers. As the initiative grew in New Jersey, we realized that there was interest from counties with detention centers and counties that didn't run detention centers. And so now the goal is to bring it to all 21 counties in the state. Currently, there are 14 sites implementing JDAI, and I'm told that there will be a 15th site by the end of March.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that's a lot. It's very impressive. What have been some of the successes to date? It must be very successful that, you know, more jurisdictions and are coming on board, even in New Jersey.
There, I think that there's been a lot of momentum here in New Jersey, and there's been a lot of information sharing and a lot of buzz around this. And it has been successful in many ways on the key measures. And let me share with you a little bit of what that looks like from our 2010 data. So from a numbers perspective, last year, New Jersey's 12 sites reduced average daily population in secure detention by 51.4% from the year before implementing JDAI to 2010. On any given day, there were 381 fewer youth in secure detention, with youth of color accounting for about 90% of this drop. Comparing the year prior to JDAI in each site to 2010. Collectively across the sites, more than 5,000 fewer youth were admitted to secure detention, a decrease of 53.9%. The number of girls in detention on any given day decreased by 58.3% across the 12 sites. So you can see that collectively these sites are all moving in the direction of reducing their detention populations by working on admissions and length of stay. And what we also know is that crime has not really changed much over the course of the years that we've been doing this. So we know that we're maintaining public safety. We know what the court appearance rates are, which when we first started, we didn't really know so much about. So things are definitely getting better here. But I think one of the most important statewide changes has been the development and implementation of a statewide risk screening tool that guides initial detention decisions. The screening tool was developed by a multidisciplinary group that included judges, prosecutors, police, public defenders, probation reps, detention administrators, and child advocates. And it was developed specifically for New Jersey. We started from scratch. We didn't take any other tools and overlay it over our work. We did this specifically for New Jersey with this group. And so the tool really does operationalize New Jersey's detention admission statute, and also creates a middle or moderate risk category for youth to avoid the detention door altogether via direct placement in a detention alternative program. So what was happening before the tool was intake, the police would call family court intake, and intake would only have two decisions to make. They could either put a youth in detention or release them. So with the advent of this tool, we've been able to create a middle category so that upon that call, the intake officers actually have a third choice, which is to place the youth in a detention alternative program. The New Jersey Supreme Court has adopted the tool as its policy, and the state is in the process of implementing the tool statewide. Importantly, the group that developed the tool continues to monitor its outcomes and its use, and the group also serves to provide the administrative director of the courts with recommendations regarding site readiness, as well as possible changes to the tool or its use over time. So this group stays together and continues to monitor what happens with the tool and how it's impacting as they roll it out to different counties around the state. And that's been a pretty incredible process.
Mm-hmm. Well, Judge Rand and David, you've been very silent and you don't get off that easy. I really want to hear about what's been happening in your counties, which are Camden and Hudson, respectively. So maybe, I don't know which one of you would like to start, but if you can let our listeners know, I think it's really important to know what the system looked like prior to implementing JDAI and sort and what has been the impact of implementing it on the system, on the juvenile justice system, on youth and families.
David, would you like me to go first or would you like to go first?
No, you can go ahead.
Okay. In Camden, when we started with JDAI, we had a very small facility. It was built for approximately 37, 38 juveniles. And we had a very, very severe overcrowding problem that lasted for years and years. At the high point, we had as many as 137 juveniles in the facility. And if we had 70 or 80, we were happy. Invariably, we'd go to 80, 90, and 100 in the better weather when more children were detained. And when we went down to 70, we thought we had helped solve a problem. The problems were, it was a way of life, the problems. It was problematic all the time. The judges were looking for patchwork fixes. We could never find an overall solution or remedy. There were safety concerns for the children, for the staff, a lot of overtime, extra staffing necessary, repeat appearances for juveniles and their parents in court because too many people would come in and we'd have to go back and forth over and over again. The judges were always searching for ways to cut back the numbers to solve the overload on the calendar and the overload on the population at the detention facility. And what we did was basically we saw the crisis. Everybody knew it was there. It wasn't even coming. It was there. And the county had always been looking at and wondering about building a new facility. Once we got into JDAI and started to deal with it, you could see the effort by the prosecutors, the public defenders, the probation department, and the legal system in trying to work together to solve a problem. JDAI let us do that. It's basically a way of life in dealing with the children who run through our system and handling them expeditiously but fairly in the least offensive manner and the least detained manner so that we could reduce our population. We've reduced it from the highs of the 137 to, most recently, I looked at our statistics for 2011, we're averaging 46 in our detention facility. So that's basically one-third of the high, or 50% of what was our average. In the meantime, we did get a new facility. That facility is built to accommodate in the mid-60s. We rarely reach that. We have basically always had under that and have had a rare opportunity to wonder about how to alleviate the problems because we don't have any. We really don't have any as far as the facilities are going. We don't have any as far as the overcrowding is concerned. And we believe that we're retaining or detaining the juveniles who deserve to be detained while allowing the youths who don't have those problems to get back to their family, to get back on the streets and go back to school while they're waiting for fair resolutions of their problems.
Great. David, is it similar in Hudson or different?
It didn't appear to be as egregious. Our numbers from the stats show that in 2000, the capacity was 79. We had a facility that's not that old. In 2000, we had 97.9 kids, 123% of capacity. But when I visited the detention center, they painted a whole different picture. They had whole wings. This was a 2000 snapshot, and I know at points it was well over 100, I think up to 130 kids. So we had, and when you talk to the people at the detention center, they paint this a picture of a really overcrowded facility where kids were not allowed to engage in any kind of extracurricular activities. They were pretty much sleeping and eating, waking, ever waking moment in the same, pretty much the same space. And it's right now, there are whole sections that are empty because we went from 97.9 in 2000 to last year 39.3 kids, which is, and we have a capacity of 79. So we had a much less overcrowding issue, but we've still managed to pretty much have that capacity number. So, yeah, it's, but I think across the board we all had issues with overcrowding. And a big part of that is we didn't really look, I think, carefully at who we were placing in the detention center. There's one thing Lisa mentioned that I should address. There, she mentioned that we haven't really had any problems safety-wise as a result of the numbers going down. I'd like to point out that I think nationwide we've seen a drop in crime, but we've seen, I know here in Hudson just last year we had, in from 08 to 09, we had a 23% drop in juvenile complaints filed. So I think it's actually enhanced or helped to improve safety, and I think that needs to be said.
Great. Are there other things you want to highlight in addition to reducing the numbers and the overcrowding about the impact of JDAI? This is it.
Well, I think.
Know,
go ahead, David.
From,
I'm sorry.
Okay. I know from my perspective, I came a little bit late to the table. It started in 03. I came in the beginning of 06. And. At that point, the courts, the prosecution, defense, probation, corrections really acted somewhat independently of each other. You'll hear me mention this over and over again, but collaboration is really the key. And we're here in Hudson always were known as a county where most lawyers wanted to come to practice because we're very accommodating. And so I thought things really worked well here. But when you go through the process, you realize that there is so much improvement that you can make that we really don't think about until we start to talk to each other. So for me, collaborating with each other and talking to each other is a huge step from where we used to be. Judge Rand.
Well, I think we've all highlighted the elimination of overcrowding, which is one of the most important goals. But additionally, even when the juveniles are released, you get more outside supervision because you're focusing on getting them back into the community, getting them back to school, getting them back with their families, and seeing that they can be properly supervised outside the youth detention facility. That's important. We've seen less confrontation in the detention center, easier control in the detention center. We've asked if there are any repeat offenders. In other words, have we let people go who have presented public safety concerns? We're not aware of any. Additionally, the county has experienced severe drop in overtime for staff, and the facility itself becomes more manageable. The judges' calendars become more manageable because they don't have to keep bringing children back and forth because they're in the detention center. You can let them go and not worry about, you can come in a month as opposed to every 2 weeks. You're not sitting there on a hotbed waiting for something to kindle and start a fire and to deal with emergencies all the time. That, to me, has been significant. I think also the collaboration is the most important thing we do. Everybody in the same boat at the same time, rowing in the same direction with the same goal. What can we do to benefit the children and help them go through the process without detaining those unnecessarily who don't deserve to be detained? That, to me, I've never saw that in my life. The prosecutors, the public defenders, the probation department, the court system, all working together, and they got everybody to work together. I've been a judge 19 years. This is the first time I saw it when I got involved with JDI about 6 or 7 years ago.
So I want to take because collaboration, I mean, we hear it, we use it all the time, but doing it is always something different, just like what you're talking about. And so I do want to explore about how you got everyone on the same page, but before I do, I want to remind our listeners, if they want to ask a question on air, to call 347-994-1149 and press the number 1 on your keypad. So getting to collaboration, and maybe, you know, all three of you actually had different experiences about this, but you're talking about bringing people together with different maybe philosophical frameworks. How did you manage that, and how did you reach consensus about the issues of detention?
Well, I'll take that first, I guess. From the state-level perspective, I think that one of the most important strategies for collaboration is getting folks used to using data, first to see what their system looks like now and be able to understand, no matter who you are in the system, what that system looks like now. I call it singing from the same sheet of music, because oftentimes when collaboratives sit down, as you say, Lauren, the prosecutor might have a different view of what the problems in the system are. The public defender might have a different view, the judge. So it's critically important to use data to help everyone get on the same page about what the system looks like now. And then the questions that are asked after that have to do with, if this is what the system looks like now, is everybody happy with this? Are we good with how all of this is going, or are there places where we might be able to improve? And that's how the collaboratives at the local level, I believe that's how the collaboratives at the local level start their work. They get a system, a detention utilization data set, it's called the snapshot, and they use that data to try to figure out what they're going to focus on first and who needs to be at the table in order to do that work. Judge Rand?
Well, what I found is, to get everybody involved, you had to figure out a way to make everybody at least acceptable or happy at the same time, at the same place. So you had to learn to work with people. And as judges, sometimes that's hard because we sit in an authoritarian position. That may have been good for this. But you need to be a consensus builder, and you need to get everyone looking at the same information at the same time, as I said, being on the same page. I found at times I had to cajole, at times I had to be forceful, and at other times I had to simply go with the flow and work with the problems that came up. But the one thing we had in Camden, and I'd be remiss if I didn't say this, is we had Mike O'Brien, who's one of the people who just really moved this matter forward. He's our trial court administrator in the county of Camden, and he never gave up with what we had. So with Michael at the point and me working with him, everyone seemed to accept the role and get together. There was a real working relationship of everybody, no one criticizing anyone else, but everybody looking at each position and each other's position to try and advance the program. Again, that's something that worked out real well with all of us, and hopefully my leadership assisted. But Mike was the one who I think really deserves the credit for pushing this matter forward, even much more than myself.
Do you have other tips for judges, Judge Rand, who may be considering this for their own county?
I do, and Lisa, you'll recall I was in Baltimore discussing this with some of their judges, and I think the first thing the judges have to understand is it's not a jailbreak. You're not simply letting everybody out for the purpose of letting it out and saying we've decreased our population. You have to satisfy yourself that the juveniles are going to get out, but not at the risk to the public. You need a buy-in by everybody. If anybody's a doubter or a naysayer, you have to convince them that this is not going to hurt the public, it's not going to hurt the system, and you're still going to do justice and treat everybody fairly. And you have to make sure that the public doesn't act up or create problems saying you're just letting people out for the purpose of letting them out. So you need to be a consensus builder. You need to get everybody together. And you do that by working with them and talking with them and letting them see what the data shows, what their problems are, and how you're going to eliminate problems. We saw that, and I think Camden is really a model of the changes that you can have, because you know, and many of the people listening will know, that Camden is one of the poorest cities in the country, and that's the county seat of Camden, and it's got a tremendous criminal population and problems, and tremendous juvenile problems. We've tried to take care of that and try to eliminate the problems that we had in our system.
David, for the prosecutors that are listening, I'm sure this is an interesting perspective too. What would you? And we've talked about safety. Public safety is actually enhanced through this thinking and by looking at alternatives. But how do you explain that participating in JDAI actually fulfills a prosecutor's duty to uphold justice and public safety?
Well, I want to reiterate that it's. And I think that's what most prosecutors need to hear, that it's not a jailbreak. Most prosecutors have an oath to do justice, and we shouldn't be looking to arrest and prosecute kids for, in my view, things that a lot of us did as kids. And I know in an urban setting like Hudson County, where eyes are always on kids, they are scrutinized a lot more closely, and the result is they encounter the police a lot more frequently, and you have arrests a lot more frequently than you would normally have. I know I grew up in the country. I got away with a lot of things that I wouldn't get away with in the city. And we need to come to the table with a perspective that we're looking for kids, and I don't normally use the term bad, but I'll put it in quotes. You're looking for the kids who are going to be a problem going forward. And I've found that this has been a tremendous way of identifying those kids, because you have everyone at the table. And if you are objective and you're going to look at the kids objectively and look at their issues objectively, you need the experience level of everyone sitting at the table, people who are involved in the system, who really have the most familiarity with the kids. And you need to come to a consensus about which kids are in need of the most services, and which ones are going to require incarceration. And it's not a term I use loosely, because I don't necessarily think that most of our kids need to be incarcerated, only a small minority. And I found that this is, and I've got almost 30 years in the system, and this has been a tremendous help in identifying those kids. So I think that's very helpful.
And the statute of limitations have run for all our activities as kids, right?
That's a whole different country, so.
Yeah. Well, I'd just like to add that I think one of the, across the board in the sites that are doing this work here in New Jersey, one of the most important things that have happened is really seeking and working hard to get kids who out of detention who are what we call low-risk, high-need kids. And these are kids who are not committing serious delinquency, but they have lots and lots of needs. They may be in the child welfare system, they may have mental health problems, they may have all these different things, and essentially the system was not doing a very good job of sort of connecting all of those dots so that we could get those kids what they needed without depriving them of their liberty. And so when we first started this work, key actors around the state would tell me, I don't want to deprive a kid like that of their liberty, but at the same time, we have no system to access the things that those kids need without putting them in the detention center first. And so I think one of the most important things that has happened here in New Jersey is that, by and large, the systems that are being developed, the detention alternative programs that are being developed, the probation work that's being done, the screening tool, all of these things are really ways of creating a system that doesn't detain someone or take someone's liberty away because they have a lot of needs. And in the end, I think that we're all pretty proud of that fact. At the same time, however, issues like racial disparity still plague us. They plague New Jersey like they plague many other places around the country. And I wanted to just mention that three of our sites in New Jersey are actually doing all of the sites are doing work with reducing racial disparities. They look at their data by race, by ethnicity, and by gender. But three sites are doing some very specific work with the W. Hayward Burns Institute on reducing racial disparities in Atlantic and in Camden and Monmouth. And so we're hoping that those sites will be able to inform the rest of the state in terms of additional ways that we can not only reduce the overall number of youth of color that are in detention, but actually reduce the proportion of youth that are in detention who are youth of color.
Are there other things you want to mention about that sounds like what you're continuing to work on through JDAI? Are there other things that you have hopes in your own counties or for the state of New Jersey?
Judge, you want to?
Well, as they tell us, you keep peeling back the onion until you get to the core to see what you have. We keep looking at the data and looking at the information available to see how we can further improve what we're dealing with. I thought we've done a pretty good job with it, but there's always more work to be done. We've looked at in Camden County about, in the future, possibly using something with JDAI for post-judgment applications and a post-judgment perspective. I don't know where that's going to go because it's something that's fairly new, but it's something that we've considered because it's another step along, and I think Annie Casey may be going there too, but I think it's very, very new. I think it's exceptionally new. It's something we're probably going to look at. There's always room for improvement. One of the ways to improve is look at where you were, where you are, and where you would like to be. I don't think we've gotten to where we'd like to be, but I can envision further process going on over the next several years and trying to improve with reducing the number. You always start with the lowest hanging fruit, a child who's there overnight who maybe you could have got out the day before. You move that child out. An example would be the child comes in late afternoon, can't get into the court system. You can get them out that evening on an electronic monitor. It's not there. The child who comes in and it takes 3 days to find the parents to get them out, to get them home, maybe you find the parents on a phone call the next day. Maybe you make it easier for them to come to court, to get them in there earlier. You have to keep improving. It's a question of how you do it and what efforts you do to do that, but I think there's still room for a lot of improvement.
Great. David, I thank you for, Judge Rand, for giving an example of how you would handle something differently. I don't know, David, if you have an example of how things have changed from a prosecutor's perspective for a child who may in the past been heading to detention.
I actually just had an example of a kid yesterday, because we do have one of the few juvenile drug courts in our jurisdiction. And he was headed to our state detention facility in Jamesburg because he kept getting reinvolved. The drug use seemed to be a subset of the real problem. Mom appeared to be the real problem. And judge sent the message strongly to mom that he would go, and mom finally got it. Sometimes, and he's doing a really wonderful job of school, sports, and, you know, we're keeping our fingers crossed, of course, but normally, without a second look, and because of JDAI, it's allowed us to focus our attention on and this is something we probably should do across the board, but we're focusing on not just the kid, but the family situation and where he's ultimately going to wind up if we continue to incarcerate him. And as opposed to producing a productive citizen, which it seems as if we're heading down that road, we probably would have produced a kid who we would have had to support. So I know there are plenty of things that we, from a prosecutor's perspective, that we have realized because of JDI, but that simple fact that we take a closer look at the kid is can't be overstated. So that's one of the things that I would encourage prosecutors to do. Take a longer, harder look at some of these kids.
I think we've definitely learned over the years about trying to individualize our responses and making sure that there's community and family engagement with every youth that we see that comes before us. Lisa, were you going to say something? I'm sorry.
I was. I wanted to share also that at the state level, you know, the state collaborative that I was talking about earlier, that there's all of these cross-cutting issues. Counties do excellent work at the local level in trying to improve their local policies and practices, but we also know that state policies and practices can often deter forward movement up to a certain point at the local level. And so the state collaborative has been working on a number of cross-cutting issues as well and seeking to change policy and practice. So, for example, there's, of course, the group that I mentioned earlier that monitors the outcomes of the risk screening tools statewide and makes sure that tool is doing what we were hoping it would do and making sure that it's being used correctly across the state. But there's also other groups that are looking at detention utilization and that are looking at access to treatment through the juvenile justice system, part of the issue I was raising before, because what we're learning as we start to peel back the onion, as Judge Rand said, is that these are local problems, but they're also statewide problems. And if we can sort of connect what the local folks are doing around making those local policy and practice changes to what the state folks do in terms of making statewide policy and practice, it's a powerful model for change.
Okay.
I would wholeheartedly agree. The risk screening tool and is turned out, I swore up and down when we introduced this risk screening tool that it would not change things in any way, shape, or form. And I'm wrong. It has. It's allowed many kids to be released who normally would not have been released before it was introduced and at no risk to the community.
Well, I think that's a really great segue. One thing I do like to ask people when they've been involved in initiatives or in collaborations, what do you know now that you wish you knew when you first began working on JDAI? If you could tell somebody, you know, one or two things, what would it be?
How challenging it would be. The urgency of the problem, even if you don't see it, when you really take a close look, there is a problem in many of these urban communities. David, similar type feelings?
A couple of things I wanted to just reemphasize or emphasize. It doesn't appear when you start out that this, I certainly didn't believe that it would be a shift of any sort. I thought we were going to go through this process and we would wind up with minimal, if any, results that we could point to. But as we've gone through it, and one thing I like to do is have people come to the table and tell us what their problems are as a jumping off point to resolving some of these problems. And once you get them sharing the problems, you realize that you've got really systemic issues that need to be resolved and can get resolved. But getting to that point it really comes down to perseverance. And I do believe that We, as Judge Rand puts it, peeling back the onion, you have to go back and peel back the onion and the layers and continue to peel back the layers, because it's a cultural shift. And I think everyone who's going into this process needs to understand that it's a huge cultural shift. It may appear to be less than it is, but it is without a doubt a major shift. And you have to continue to go back to places that you've already been and readdress and re-review issues that have already, you think, been resolved. And that's my biggest advice to anyone who wants to be involved with this.
Okay. Yeah. Sure. Yes. And I have a couple of things actually. I think that certainly, as Judge Rand and Dave have mentioned, keeping an open mind is critically important when you start this work. You have to sort of approach the work as, you know, I'm just going to stay open about this and sort of see what comes of the process, because what happens sometimes is folks get very territorial around the table and, you know, they want to say, well, you know, I'm doing everything right and somebody else is doing everything wrong, and that's why the system looks this way. And, you know, from a collaboration perspective, it's critically important that people are willing to both see the flaws in what other people are doing and see the flaws in what they're doing. There is no problem in juvenile justice that is caused by one group or entity. There's always several decision-making points and several things that are going on from different places. So being open is really important. And also always asking why. This is something that Judge Iadanza out of Monmouth County always talks about. He talks about the fact that, you know, just sitting down and saying, why do we do it this way? Is there some other way to do it, is often a pretty powerful thing, because if the answer is a reasonable answer, then maybe folks go forward with that process. But, you know, if people are like, I don't know, that's just the way we do it, then maybe it requires a little bit of further investigation. And then having or getting good data and learning how to use it is so incredibly important to doing this work. Not only does it level the playing field, but having data helps you to know that the change you made was a good one or not so good one, so that you can make a different change if you're not getting the outcomes that you want. And having that sort of diagnostic view and being able to use information not only to diagnose but to see what happened as a result of what you changed is really what creates institutionalization and sustainability of this work over the long haul. And the corollary to that is not getting so much data that you're completely overwhelmed and you don't know what thing to look at first, and that's just very frustrating. So there's a balance there. And that sort of leads me to my final suggestion, which is that folks who are not familiar or even are familiar should go on the JDAI help desk. All of this information about JDAI, site information, local site information, policy, procedure manuals, all kinds of things are on the JDAI help desk, which folks can find at www.jdaihelpdesk.org. Great. Lots of great information there.
We did have one question that maybe someone can answer, and if none of you can, that's fine as well. We don't have anyone who is from the Public Defender's Office on this show, but is there any way one of you can quickly say how the public defenders, children's attorneys have been involved in JDAI and sort of their impact on their own practice?
I saw it in Camden County because we've had active involvement from several of the public defenders, and they've helped immensely. But I think if you look at it from their perspective, it's benefiting their customers, clients, people they represent, but they've been wonderful. I mean, they've done everything to help us and offer suggestions at times to deal with problems that the prosecutor were willing to look at.
Mm-hmm. I would echo those sentiments. I think they bring a whole different perspective, as we all do, to the table. They're the ones who speak to the kids, and know what, well, they're most familiar with a lot of issues that no one else is familiar with or will be familiar with, and without divulging confidences and breaking their oath, they can generally address issues that we, without them, we would never have any idea that they existed.
Thank you. Well, we only have 4 minutes left, okay, and then I promised Judge Rand he'd get back on the bench. He has a full docket today. So I guess I would just ask for final comments right now.
I prepared – one of the things that we had kicked around was tips for future stakeholders, and I looked at it and said, what are my top 10? I got 8. I'd like to give you those tips, and hopefully people could look at them, and I think it's a pretty good starting point if you want to get involved. First, set objectives. 2, keep talking, bring the community involved, bring the police into it. Remember, they start most of this. 3, give it time to mature. Things don't happen instantaneously. Never give up. Keep reviewing, keep discussing, keep going over the data, and keep looking at it. Only detain those juveniles who need to be detained. Avoid personal agendas, and be prepared to self-analyze and be critical of the position you take, be critical of the position your neighbor takes, and never maintain the status quo. Always try to move forward. There's about 10 in there. I only had it with 8, but there's about 10 in there for the top 10 reasons or top 10 things you should be looking at if you want to be a stakeholder and try and help what's going on with the overpopulation and the over-detaining situation with the juveniles.
Great. David, Elisa, 30 seconds.
No preconceived notions about what exists. You're more than likely wrong. I think if you're going to be a JDI site and try to change any part of the system, you need to identify, in most cases, only a couple of key stakeholders who are going to be vigilant and persevere for years. It sounds like a daunting task, but it's not if you care about kids. That's pretty much my advice.
Thank you. Lisa?
I'm going to quote my friend Mike O'Brien that Judge Rand talked about before and say that really this work is about small changes that you make over time that lead to big results in terms of systems change and reductions in the detention center. There is no one change that you're going to make that's going to lead to huge reductions, so you have to know up front that the small things that you do accumulate relatively quickly to seeing big results on the other side.
Perfect. Thank you to all three of you for being on today's show, and thank you, listeners, for tuning in. The show will be available on demand at blogtalkradio.com/spotlightonyouth. We will also have some resources posted on Children's Law Center's website at childrenslawky.org that Lisa sent to us. We'll be on the air next Friday, March 18th, back at our usual time of 3 p.m. Eastern. That episode will focus on trauma-informed care for delinquent youth. Our guests will include Judge Michael Howard, Sean Marsh, who is the director of the Juvenile and Family Law Department of the National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges, and Dr. Erna Olafson. Spotlight on Youth is a project of the Children's Law Center, Inc., a not-for-profit children's rights legal services organization. So to stay informed about upcoming shows, you can either follow us here at Blog Talk Radio or at Children's Law's website. Take care and see you next time on Spotlight on Youth. Thank you again.
You're welcome.
Lisa,
have a great day, Lauren.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.